taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
He'll stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were every day American.
Well, hello, everyday Americans, and welcome. Welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and we study the Constitution and we teach the rising generation to be free. I am glad you could join me. You know, I'm reminded of an ancient Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. And boy, are we living in some interesting times. In fact, over the last year, I'd say they turned the interesting up to 11. It has been crazy from a constitutional standpoint, which means this broadcast, this program, and the content that we bring is probably more important than ever. Now, you may be asking yourself, what is the Constitution Study? I mean, this is my first episode on the America Out Loud Network. I'm sure there's a lot of people who haven't heard of me or the Constitution Study or the work that we're doing. And I do plan over the next several days to give you more of an introduction to me and to the study and to the work we're doing and how we go about doing it. But your first question is probably, what's this program all about? Well, that's a good question. See, one of the things I do in my job is I collect news articles. I get several different news feeds from different locations. I listen to a bunch of podcasts, and I'm always on the lookout for an article or a current event or something that I can use as an educational tool from the Constitution Study. So what I'm going to be doing in this program is I'm going to be taking several of those news articles, several of those pieces of current events that I find, and I'm going to be doing some research on them so I understand them better and discuss them with you from a constitutional standpoint. The idea is I'm doing the reading, I'm doing the studying, I'm hoping to encourage you to do that as well, but it's about teaching not only what the Constitution says, but as John Jay said, by reading the Constitution, we will sooner know when our rights are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. And that's what I want to do. I want us to recognize that when our rights are under attack, I want us to know not only how to defend and assert them, but how to do so properly, how to do so effectively, and how to do so not just for ourselves, but for our neighbors and for our posterity. And that kind of brings me to today's first article, and it's actually one that I wrote called The Zombie Amendment.
Ronald Reagan said, "A government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth." Apparently, that's no longer true, since there's also a dead proposed amendment that simply will not go away. Sounding like Dr. Frankenstein, the House of Representatives is crying, "It's alive!" when it's actually dead. On March 17, 2021, the House of Representatives voted 222 to 204 to ignore the language of the dead Equal Rights Amendment. Now, many claim that the resolution passed, but if we read the Constitution, we'll find that, well, no such thing happened. From House Joint Resolution 17, quote, "Resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that notwithstanding any time limit contained in House Joint Resolution 208, 92nd Congress, as agreed to in the Senate on March 22, 1972, the article of amendment proposed to the states in that joint resolution shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the United States Constitution whenever ratified by the legislature of three-fourths of the several states." Now, the resolution seems simple enough if we just ignore the language of the amendment that pertains to the deadline for ratification. However, that brings up the first problem. You see, should the dead amendment be adopted, it would read as follows, quote, "Resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, two-thirds of each house concurring therein, that the following article is proposed as an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission by the Congress." If you look at the right-hand border of the document, you can see that the date of submission was March 23, 1972. That's 50 years ago, well past the 7-year deadline in the resolution itself. So if we added this to the Constitution, as the House of Representatives wishes, we would have an amendment that directly contradicts its own ratification. This is not the first time Congress has tried to bypass the amendment process. Not only Congress, but several states also seem to want to ignore what the dead Equal Rights Amendment actually says, which I discussed previously in my video, Serving Expired Kool-Aid. Here, though, we have the Congress claiming to pass a resolution without actually passing it. See, Article 5 of the Constitution includes, quote, "The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution." Now, there are those in the House of Representatives who want to change the dead Equal Rights Amendment, but see, they don't have the votes to do so. Do they actually believe they can ignore the amendment process to get what they want? H.J. 17 is an attempt to remove language from the dead Equal Rights Amendment. Since that amendment has already been submitted to the states, Congress can't simply modify it. They need to propose a new amendment. Even if H.J. 17 was an attempt to propose a modified version of the Equal Rights Amendment, it did not, as is claimed by Congress, pass the House of Representatives since it did not get the two-thirds votes required by Article 5. Since H.J. 17 did not receive the number of votes in the House of Representatives necessary to proceed as an amendment to the Constitution, this should once again be a dead issue. Instead, claiming that the amended amendment passed when it did not, this zombie amendment simply will not die. It's being kept alive by a lawless leadership in Congress, their accomplices in the media, and the ignorance of the American people. So why am I making such a big deal about this Frankenstein's monster of an amendment proposal? In drafting the Massachusetts Constitution, John Adams noted that they were creating, quote, "a government of laws, not of men." That's from Article 30. If this nation is also to be run by a government of laws and not of men, those in government must be forced to obey those laws. Article 6 of the Constitution not only declares it is the supreme law of the land, but that all government office holders at all levels are required to swear or affirm the support of the Constitution in their oath of office. Quote, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. The senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. But no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." Those who voted for this resolution to ignore the language of the dead Equal Rights Amendment violated that oath by asking Congress to ignore the very law that created it. The leadership members who continue to claim that H.J. 17 passed the House of Representatives not only violate their oaths, but are committing perjury. As defined in Webster's 1828 dictionary, perjury is, quote, "the act or crime of willfully making a false oath when lawfully administered, or a crime committed when a lawful oath is administered in some judicial process to a person who swears willfully, absolutely, and falsely in a manner material to the issue." Now, since this act of perjury was not committed in a judicial proceeding, I do not believe it is a crime, though the act of willfully making a false statement while acting under their oath of office does seem to indicate they've perjured themselves morally, if not criminally. There are those in Washington, D.C., with their willing accomplices in the media, who want to trick you into believing that the Equal Rights Amendment is still alive and able to be ratified. This is a lie and a perversion of the rule of law. If those who wish to resurrect the ERA were to propose a new amendment in Congress, well, they are more than able to do so. It is my belief, however, that they recognize that the chances of actually getting two-thirds of both houses of Congress to vote for such an amendment are extremely slim at best. So rather than following the law, they continue to claim that a lie is the truth and that a simple majority can change an amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I believe they do this in the hope that the American people know so little about their Constitution that they'll let them get away with it. That would not only be a setback for the rule of law, but the further destruction of the blessings of liberty that the Constitution was written to secure to us and our children. The questions are, will the American people allow their employees in Congress to break the law? Will they allow them to damage the Republic and drive us further into tyranny? All in the name of some well-titled amendment?
Now, don't get me wrong. We all want equal rights. I believe most Americans want equal rights, and they want them not just for themselves, but for their friends and family and neighbors. But I have to ask, if we're going to ignore what the Constitution says about amending it, does it matter anymore? What does it say about the American people that we hire people to represent us that simply ignore not only the law, but their oath to support it? You see, whether or not you agree with the Equal Rights Amendment or what it wants to do or how it goes about doing it, if we pass an amendment that contradicts its own ratification, what does it matter anymore? What does law matter anymore if we're not going to bother following it? It's one of the reasons people ask, does the Constitution matter? If those in Congress are not going to follow the Constitution, does it really matter? Now, I want to take a look at another article. This one actually deals with taxes. You may have heard that Elizabeth Warren, once again, has proposed a wealth tax, a tax on the net wealth. And of course, it's going to only be on the rich. Isn't it interesting how it's always only on the rich, or the ultra-millionaire tax, as it's some people have called it. And I've seen a lot of articles talking about its effectiveness. You know, what would it do to the economy and all? And will it improve income? Will it decrease overall income? Will it force the wealthy to find ways to avoid this tax, to move funds offshore? And these are all very good arguments, but they miss one really, really important point. A federal wealth tax is illegal. Now, to understand this, we have to start with a basic foundation. It's something I'll go into deeper later in this program, not in this episode, but in a future episode, is that the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land. It supersedes state law. It supersedes state constitution. And it is only recognized federal laws, laws of the United States created pursuant to the Constitution. So if we're going to have a wealth tax, the first thing we have to do is find out, well, is it constitutional? Now, Article 1, Section 8 lists most of the powers delegated to Congress. These are powers that the states, through the Constitution, have delegated to the United States, specifically to the House of Congress. And the first clause says, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So Congress has the authority to tax, but that is not an unlimited tax. Notice a couple of things. One is they can collect taxes, they can collect duties, they can collect imposts and excises, and they can do those for specific purposes. We'll get into the question of the general welfare clause and common defense clause again in a future episode, but understand, we have delegated to Congress the authority to tax, to collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. But that's not an unlimited authority. Now, to understand this, we have to start with a basic foundation. It's something I'll go into deeper later in this program, not in this episode, but in a future episode, is that the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land. It supersedes state law. It supersedes state constitution. And it is only recognized federal laws, laws of the United States created pursuant to the Constitution. So if we're going to have a wealth tax, the first thing we have to do is find out, well, is it constitutional? Now, Article 1, Section 8 lists most of the powers delegated to Congress. These are powers that the states, through the Constitution, have delegated to the United States, specifically to the House of Congress. And the first clause says, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So Congress has the authority to tax, But that is not an unlimited tax. Notice a couple of things. One is they can collect taxes, they can collect duties, they can collect imposts and excises, and they can do those for specific purposes. We'll get into the question of the general welfare clause and common defense clause again in a future episode. But understand, we have delegated to Congress the authority to tax, to collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. But that's not an unlimited authority. You see, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 reads, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers. Meaning that not only is the House of Representatives apportioned based on the census, on the enumeration of the population of the United States, of the citizens of the United States, but so are direct taxes. See, the federal government wasn't originally allowed to tax the people directly. When the Congress imposed a tax under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, if it was a tax directly on the people, it was actually apportioned to the states, and the states would collect the tax. Now, this was a very important safeguard. It was an insulation between the people and the federal government. The federal government had no authority to go into your wallet to collect taxes. It had to come through the state. The state then had the authority to determine how they were going to collect that tax. Now, some states might do it on an income, some states might do it on a sales, but the point was the states, which are closer to the people, were the ones that were collecting direct taxes. Then we had 1913 and the 16th Amendment. I personally hate the 16th Amendment, and not because I have to file taxes every year, but the 16th Amendment reads that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. See, for the first time, the federal government not only had the legal authority to tax your income, they had a reason to know what you made, what you spent it on. Before 1913, unless you were in the military, your only contact with the federal government was probably the post office. But now, not only does the government care everything that you make, they care everything you spend it on. The federal government is not only in your pocket, in your wallet, but they are literally following you around to see, you know, are you making money and what are you spending on something they will give you a deduction for. But it's a very important part of this clause. They are able to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived. Now, I'm big into words, into definitions, and I like to use Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary. Let me explain why for a moment. Noah Webster was not one of the framers, but he was a contemporary of the framers. In fact, he was invited by Alexander Hamilton to edit the Federalist Papers. And the reason I use him is, as a contemporary, he would understand the way words were used at the time that our framers were forming the Constitution and the different articles and amendments, at least many of them. And he would give us the best impression of what the framers meant when they wrote these words. Now, granted, this amendment was written in 1913, but again, if we're understanding the concepts, the idea that our framers put in place, I like to use his dictionary. So Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary, it's available online. Just do a search for Webster Dictionary or go to WebsterDictionary1828.com. And it says that income is the gain which proceeds from labor, business, or property of any kind. And he gives some examples like the produce of a farm, the rent of houses, the proceeds of professional businesses, the profits of commerce or of occupation, the interest of money or stock and funds. All of these are considered income. So all of these would fall under the power of the 16th Amendment to be taxed. Now, for those of you who may wonder about the use of an older dictionary, well, the current Merriam-Webster dictionary says that income is a gain or recurring benefit, usually measured in money that derives from capital or labor. The same basic concept. You work, you develop something, you sell something, you run a business. All of these are considered income, which is why we have an income tax. It's why we report not only salaries, but rental income, the profit of a business, interest we make on different investments. These are all income. But income is not wealth. See, wealth is what is left over after You've paid all your expenses, including your taxes. So not only is Congress, or at least Senator Warren, looking to tax what has already been taxed once, in other words, they want a second bite at the apple, but they're missing one very important part. They do not have the legal authority to tax wealth. Unless it's income, unless it's an increase in value, unless it's a salary or interest or something, Congress does not have the legal authority to tax it. Which brings me to another very important point, and it's a part of the Constitution I want you to all remember. That is the 10th Amendment, which reads, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people." So if a power has not been delegated to the United States by the Constitution, and the taxing of wealth is one of those powers that has not been delegated to the United States, and it's not prohibited to the states, then it is reserved. It's reserved to the states and to the people. In other words, it's a violation of the Constitution for the federal government to institute a wealth tax. The same way as in 1912 and before, it was illegal for the federal government to directly tax the income of the people. They had to amend the Constitution for it to be legal. But since so few Americans know what the Constitution says, and since so many politicians have gotten away with ignoring the Constitution, with in some cases even vilifying the Constitution and the limits it puts on the federal government, now they look at it and say, well, we can get away with this. So does the Constitution matter? Does the Constitution matter if a senator can propose year after year after year an illegal tax on the American people? Does the Constitution matter if we have the American people not only hiring this senator, the people of Massachusetts have hired this senator to represent the state, but the representatives of the rest of the 50 states will be voting on this proposal, on this attempt to instill an illegal tax? Does the Constitution still matter? And another important question I want to bring up is, what can we the people do? You know, you and me, we're everyday Americans. We're trying to make a living. We're trying to raise our families. We're trying to do what is right. What can we do in the face of a lawless senator, a senator or a member of Congress, or any employee of the people, anybody who's been hired by the people to represent them? What do we do when they simply ignore their oath of office? Now, that's a very important question. I want to take the time to answer that, and I want to answer that in detail. So I'm going to do that a little later in the broadcast, but I want you thinking along these lines. You know, we hire representatives. We set rules and laws for them. What happens when our employees ignore those rules? Ignore the laws we've put in place. So as I get ready to head off to a quick break and allow our sponsors a chance to encourage you to help support this program, I want you to know that a program like this, the Constitution Study, does not exist all by itself. There are a lot of people that help support the work that we're doing here, and many of them simply by sharing this information. So I encourage you to share what you're learning here today, share this program. And I also want to specifically thank the Harlan Henry Band. They have kindly allowed me to use their music in this program. So when you hear the song Everyday Americans, that comes from the Harlan Henry Band. You can find out more at harlanhenry.com. I also want to remind you that this radio program also comes out as a podcast. All of my shows go to podcasts. Usually takes a day or two after it's heard on the radio, but you can hear all of them. You can hear them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, iHeart Podcast, basically whatever podcast application you use. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast, and please give me a rating on Apple Podcasts. That helps support the program. It helps encourage people to advertise the program. It helps people find this program and the information that we're trying to share here. Information that is so important if we're going to continue to be a self-governed, free republic. So we'll take a quick break, and I will see you on the other side with more from the Constitution Study.
The America Out Loud family is comprised of patriots in the true sense of the word. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty and the Constitution to help save America for future generations to come. AmericaOutloud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Welcome back to the Constitution Study. I'm glad you could join me. We are questioning, does the Constitution matter? And we're going to pick up with another tax proposal. Now, this one has kind of flip-flopped. While Elizabeth Warren has been pretty steadfast on her desire to implement a wealth tax, we have Pete Buttigieg, who's, I guess he's flip-flopped. He did propose in the end of March, a mileage tax. Now, this is an interesting question. When I first moved to Middle Tennessee, I met with my state representative and my state senator, and I asked them, what are the big concerns? What are the big issues you're dealing with down here? And their concern was the gas tax on electric vehicles. Now, from their standpoint, you know, as the country moved more and more towards electric vehicles and other forms of energy, the gas tax, which is supposed to be used and hopefully is used to maintain the roads, well, it'd be less and less effective, right? Because if people are using less and less gas because they're using an electric vehicle, where's the tax dollars coming from? Now, I have a whole other issue with mileage taxes, and I told them that I would see if I could come up with a better answer, which I haven't really yet. But again, we're dealing with not with a state mileage tax, but a federal mileage tax. Now, Secretary Buttigieg was on CNN with Jake Tapper, and when asked how they were going to fund President Biden's infrastructure plan, again, a discussion for another day, Secretary Buttigieg floated the idea of using a mileage tax as a way to subsidize the roads, bridges, and tunnels that they would be maintaining and constructing. Well, whether or not you believe a mileage tax as opposed to a gasoline tax, or in addition to, if we know the federal government, whether you believe that's effective or not, again, we have the same question we have with the mileage tax. As we have already gone through, Congress is not authorized to collect taxes directly from the American people, although they can collect excises and duties. Now, again, Noah Webster defines an excise as an inland duty or impost laid on commodities consumed or on the retail, which is the last state before consumption, as an excise on coffee, soap, candles, which a person consumes in his family. So Again, the federal government has the authority to collect excises or inland duties or foreign duties. But we're still stuck with that requirement from Article 1, Section 2 that says direct taxes must be apportioned to the states. So the federal government does not have the legal authority to directly tax the people except on income. Thank you, 16th Amendment. So what happens when we get to a mileage tax, when a mileage tax is proposed? And again, I've seen subsequent articles that this has really been backed off of because there was a lot of kickback. And interesting, not because anybody making a point that the federal government doesn't have the authority to tax mileage. Yes, I mean, they can impose an excise, but again, direct taxes must be placed on the states and then the states collected. Now, how's the government gotten around this in the past? Well, perfect example is a gasoline tax, since we're talking about things of that nature. You see, the federal government says we're not directly taxing the people, we're collecting the tax from the gas sellers. See, when I was younger, you used to pull into a gas station, and on the pump was not just the price of the gas, but they used to list all the taxes that were collected. And I remember when I, you know, had my first car, gasoline was about a buck and a half a gallon. And you'd look at that, and sometimes as little as 35, 40 cents of that buck and a half you paid for a gallon of gas was the actual cost of the gas. You had a federal gas tax, a state gas tax, you had all sorts of other taxes that were added onto it that brought the price up to a buck and a half. I have no idea what those numbers are today, because many states outlawed actually informing the consumer how much the state and federal government was taking for that gallon of gas they were purchasing at the pump. But we look at it and say, well, you know, the federal government, we're not actually taxing directly the people. We're taxing the businesses. They're collecting the tax for us. See, you have to remember, businesses don't pay taxes. They pass taxes through. So we're back to that question. Well, is it a direct tax? Well, are they directly taxing the business owners? Are they getting the business owners to act as an agent of the federal government by collecting federal taxes, which they then later remit to the IRS or whatever agency they send it to? Yes. See, we're still dealing with the basic question of a direct tax. We're dealing with the federal government, the United States of America, directly taxing the people and their businesses. And they're doing so without apportioning it to the states. See, that's where ignorance of the Constitution, what it says and what it means, has allowed the federal government to gain so much power because they're collecting taxes from so many different places. Now, yes, we gave them the legal authority to tax our income. I think that was a very bad idea. I think it actually helped destroy the Republic. I actually wrote a book that described how the 16th and 17th Amendments to the Constitution destroyed the Republic that is the United States of America. But what we found over the years is the federal government doesn't even need to pass an amendment anymore. They're creating these illegal agencies. They're creating these illegal taxes. They're violating their oath of office. They're violating the law day in and day out. And they get away with it because the American people don't do anything about it. So we're back to that question. Does the Constitution matter? Does it matter or not? If we're not going to enforce what the Constitution says, does it really matter? So now I'm going to look at something a little different. You may question at first when I bring this up, but I actually want to talk about the recent spat, what's been going on in the House of Representatives regarding the election for the 2nd District of Iowa for a member to the House of Representatives. Now, I've seen several different articles describing the actions of Nancy Pelosi and the House Administration Committee in this attempt to question. I want to be fair. I want to be generous, and we'll say that the House is questioning the election of Representative Marionette Miller Meeks from the 2nd Congressional District of Iowa. This is an extremely close election. In fact, it came down to 6 votes. 6 votes. So the next time someone tells you that their vote doesn't matter, well, 6 people in the state of Iowa made a huge difference when it comes to their representation in Congress. But of course, this is a very close election, and I've heard what's being done as anywhere from questioning to actual outright theft. Now, some of this comes from political rancor, and you know, I agree with President Washington. Political parties will be the destruction of the republic. That's another topic for another day. But and I would not be surprised to find that the reason that the House of Representatives is going after this particular House seat is because it is now held by a Republican. The House is controlled by the Democratic Party. And as Washington said, the alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge natural to party dissension, which in different ages and countries has perpetuated the most horrid enormities, is itself a frightful despotism. Again, take a look at the last several years and what do you see? I see frightful despotism. I think that's an accurate description. So this is not a political show, so I'm not so much focusing on the party politics of this, but is it constitutional? Well, if we read Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1, each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. So the House of Representatives has the legal, the constitutional authority to be a judge of the election and the qualification of one of its members. Now, is this being done, again, for political purposes? Is there a political bias to this? I would be shocked if there wasn't. And oh, by the way, not because it's the Democrats. I would expect pretty much the same thing from the Republicans. As far as I'm concerned, a pox on both their houses. The Republicans have certainly shown themselves willing to use the levers of power to their advantage and the disadvantage of their political opponents. Are they better at it than the Democrats or not? Again, that's a discussion for someone else. But the House of Representatives has the legal authority to judge the qualifications of its members and to judge their elections. Now, why did we do this? Why did our founding fathers give the houses of Congress the authority to review the elections and the returns for their members? Well, remember, we're dealing with a union of states. And states are made up of people. They elect people to positions of authority to represent them. And those people are human beings. They're therefore flawed. And the concern that came out was, well, what happens if a House seat is chosen, a person is elected by illegal means? What if the someone who I don't know, bought and sold a Senate seat? We've heard of that before, haven't we? What would happen? Well, the idea was the House or the Senate, depending on which House had a member, would have the authority to look at what was going on and judge whether that was fair or not. And the idea was, of all the members of the House or all the members of the Senate, there would be enough honor that you could not get a majority of the House for political reasons to overturn a close election. The idea was simple. If there was real evidence of malfeasance, of a problem with the election of a member of the House or a member of the Senate, then the members would be honor-bound to question the return, to question that election. But if it was merely a close election, the majority would be honor-bound to not overturn the will of the people simply because they didn't like the outcome. Now, is that what is happening in the House of Representatives as we look at this Iowa 2nd Congressional District? Well, I'm not a mind reader. I can't tell you what's in the hearts and minds of the people, Nancy Pelosi and the people on the House Administration Committee. I can't. I have my opinion, and I think I've given you a clue as to what that opinion might be, but it is simply an opinion. But again, we come back to the question of, does the Constitution matter? All of these people who are claiming that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are trying to steal a House election because they are exercising their duly delegated authority to be the final judge of the election of a House member. Well, does the Constitution matter or not? See, if we're going to complain when members of the government ignore the Constitution, we really should complain when members of the media or the public ignore the Constitution as well. Now, again, I don't want to get into a political debate, but does the Constitution matter? Does it matter that it is illegal for Senator Warren, for her wealth tax, that is illegal, or for Secretary Buttigieg's mileage tax is illegal? Does it also matter that the House is the judge of the elections of its members? But then we bring up another question. What if the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats on the House Administration Committee, what if they are cooking the books? What if they are playing games? What if they're using their spirit of revenge as a despotism to overturn the election of a group of the American people? Well, I know many people, their first instinct is to, you know, throw the bums out or sue or do something. We can't let this happen. But you see, there's a problem. And it's not simply that the Constitution matters. See, it's our own ignorance of how the federal government is designed to work. Nancy Pelosi holds her seat in Congress because a majority of the people in her district, at least the majority of the ones who voted, believe she is a good representation of their will. Now, you may disagree with it. You may think it's criminal. You may think it's un-American, but it is their opinion. They have expressed that opinion through an election. And since we have given so much control of our government over to the political parties, again, a discussion for another day, she has won the power, the office of Speaker. In other words, a majority of the House of Representatives, a majority of the people that we the people have elected to represent us, to exercise our sovereign power, have chosen her to be the Speaker of the House, to decide who is on which committees and what those opinions will be. In other words, we can complain all we want, but ultimately, this is our fault. Every member of Congress is an employee. They are employees of we the people. We hired them when we elected them. Now, you may not have voted for that person specifically, but as a group, we hired the representatives of our district to exercise our sovereign authority in our name, and this is the work that they're doing. Think about that the next time you you read a report about how Congress has an average between 50 and 30% approval rating. They're your representatives. They are our employees. We've hired them. And what they're doing in our name. I love the quote by President James Garfield. He was president at the centennial in 1876, and in his speech he said, quote, "Now more than ever before, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. If that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it is because the people tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. If it be intelligent, brave, and pure, it is because the people demand these high qualities to represent them in the national legislature." And I think that's well put. See, if we don't like what Congress is doing, it's our fault. If we look at Congress and they are ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it's because we tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. If it is intelligent, brave, and pure, well, that's because we demand those high qualities. Now, step back from political parties. Again, a pox on both their houses. Is your representative intelligent, brave, pure, or are they ignorant, recklessness, and corrupt? And again, it's not truly a binary question, right? Some things they do are good, some things they do are bad. Some things they do may be ignorant, some things they do may be brave. But as a whole, as an overall, is that person representing you properly? Are they exercising the powers we've delegated to them? You know, the Declaration of Independence says governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. We consent to the power given to the federal government by the Constitution of the United States. Are they following that power? And now I'm going to answer the question I've been asking this entire episode is, does the Constitution matter? You see, we're all looking for people to blame. We're looking for someone to point the finger at and says, it's your fault and you have to go fix it. Sometimes we don't look at a person. Sometimes we look at a document. We say, here's the document of the Constitution. It should fix our problems. We forget that the Constitution is ink on parchment. It's words on paper. It's ideas. The Constitution is not going to get up out of its case and start dope slapping the people in Congress that are ignoring it. It's not going to handcuff the people that are violating the law. It is ink on parchment. But it's those ideas that are important, because those ideas, the fact that we put them down, that we established the boundaries for our elected officials, for our government officials, it is the justification for us to hold them accountable. When the Affordable Care Act was being debated in Congress, a certain elected official, oh, it was Nancy Pelosi, she was Speaker of the House, and she was asked where the Constitution gave Congress the authority to pass such legislation. Does anybody remember what her response was? Quote, "Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?" That is the representation in Congress. And I certainly don't think that is intelligent, brave, and pure. In fact, I believe that's evil and corrupt. But the only way to deal with that evil and corruption is to recognize the Constitution sets rules. It sets boundaries. I'll do an episode where I talk about the Supremacy Clause, and we'll talk about that in future episodes. But we need to understand that when whether it's a member of Congress or a member of a state or federal, a government official violates the Constitution, they are breaking the law. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and like any other law, it is meaningless if it is not enforced. And we keep looking for the federal government to enforce the rules on themselves. That's like going to a football game and expecting the football players to enforce the rules rather than the referees, rather than the umpire and the other judges. It's like going to a baseball game and expecting the batter to call balls and strikes. Sure, we have a court system, a federal court system, that is supposed to be independent, but it's still part of the government. Judges are almost never purely umpires calling balls and strikes. We like to think of them that way, but they're not. That's why we refer to judges, especially federal judges, either by the party or the president that appointed them. We talk about the Supreme Court. Some people call it a conservative court because a majority of the members of that court were appointed by Republican presidents. Well, if they're Republicans or they're conservatives, does that mean they are unbiased umpires? Merely calling balls and strikes? That they have no political agenda in their heart? Are they suddenly superhuman, without fault, without error, without bias? No. The Constitution matters because it is our justification for holding them accountable. It is our justification to look at what Ms. Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, is doing in Iowa and say, is it constitutional? And as well as to look back at what she said about the Affordable Care Act and say, is that constitutional? It's our authority to look at our representative and our senators and ask them, have you upheld your oath of office to support the Constitution? See, because of what I do, around election time, I do have candidates that ask for my endorsement. Actually, I frequently have people who ask me to endorse their preferred candidate. I don't do that, but I do have one criteria for my representative. Again, U.S. House, U.S. Senate, State House, State Senate. My first and primary criteria are, did you uphold your oath of office? Did you support the Constitution as it is written? Not as some lawyer told you was okay or some judge found some loophole in, as it is written. Did you uphold your oath of office? That's why the Constitution matters. When I had a House of member in the U.S. House who supported legislation that was blatantly unconstitutional, I wrote them. And I explained to them why what they were doing was wrong, why it was unconstitutional. And I made one very simple point. See, if they're not going to follow their oath of office, I told them it was not only my job, it was my responsibility, it was my duty to find someone better to represent the people of my district. You know, there's a joke that goes around, and you probably hear me say it a lot, how can you tell when a politician is lying? Their lips are moving. Yet we hire them. What does it say about the American people that we routinely hire people we know are lying to us? And the people who lie the best are the ones we seem to hire most frequently. The Constitution is the law. It sets the standard. But we, the people, are the ones that are supposed to enforce that law. And we don't want, we really want someone else to do it for us. And because we have backed off of that, because we have allowed others to take up the mantle, because we have not held to our responsibility to be free citizens in a free republic, the blessings of liberty are disappearing. The sacred fire of liberty is going out. And as much as we want to point at the people that are doing it, they are symptoms of a much larger problem. That problem is the ignorance and apathy of the American people. People who have been taught and now believe that the Constitution is just too complicated for the average person to understand. You have to have a law degree to understand it. That believe it's up to Congress and the judges to actually do all the work. And we can just sit back and collect what other goodies and benefits governments like to send our way. The problem with Congress isn't Congress. It's the American people who hire them. And the problem with the federal government isn't those who sit in government. It's the American people that let their representatives getting away with not holding other elected officials accountable. It's we the people who have not read and studied the Constitution, who have not taught the rising generation to be free. As an example of how easy it is, let me read to you the preamble to the Constitution. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Is that complicated? Do you want to know why we have a Constitution? Yes, it's to make the union better. It's to establish justice, not racial justice or social justice or economic justice, just plain justice. To help ensure domestic tranquility so we do not have fights between the states that we see today. To provide for a common defense. I believe it was Benjamin Franklin that said, "We must all hang together or we will surely all hang separately." I believe it was when they signed the Declaration of Independence. Well, the same is true today. The states alone cannot defend themselves as well as they can together. And the people cannot defend themselves alone as well as they can together. Yes, it's to promote the blessings of liberty, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. So when we see people violating the Constitution, when we see government officials, elected officials, violating their oath of office to support that Constitution, we're not simply seeing someone misbehaving. We're seeing people not only violate the law, but they are diminishing the blessings of liberty for ourselves, for our neighbors, for our children, and for our grandchildren. And we, the people, have to ask ourselves, are we going to let that happen? So again, be sure to check out America Out Loud. Make it your daily stop for the latest news and happenings. It's important we all do our part. Share these stories, share these articles, the podcast, the videos, all that we can do so we can help secure not only America's future, but the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for our posterity. And I'll see you here again tomorrow at the Constitution Study.